Welcome to your own health and fitness. I'm health integration specialist Lena Berman, and I come to you weekly to discuss self-care and integrated health. Seafood has been a staple of the human diet since the dawn of man. Recent nutritional research has highlighted the health benefits of long-chain omega-3 fatty acids found in fish, and further studies have shown that promoting a good balance of fats in our diets, favoring the omega-3s, can help to protect us from heart disease, inflammation, cancer, even depression and other psychiatric symptoms. Humans have come to count on the oceans for what has seemed like an endless bounty. Now that human population has expanded, an end is in sight. Some fish are endangered and others are on their way. And farmed fish isn't always a benign alternative. Today, joining me by phone to talk about where we are in our relationship to the health of oceans and how to make protective choices that will protect our health and their health in choosing seafood options is senior biologist at the Monterey Bay Aquarium, Dr. Stephen Webster. I believe you're there, are you not, Stephen?
I'm here, Lena. Hi.
Hi. Let me give you a little intro here. Dr. Stephen Webster is, as I said, the senior biologist at the Monterey Bay Aquarium and has been involved with the institution since its inception in 1976. Dr. Webster studied biology at Stanford and taught at Northfield Mount Hermon School in Massachusetts for 5 years. In 65, he returned to Stanford and its Hopkins Marine Station in Pacific Grove. He received his doctorate from Stanford in 1971 and from 71 to 77 taught invertebrate zoology at San Jose State, during which time he led summer marine biology courses for divers in the Caribbean on Grand Cayman and St. Cruz. In 1978, he left San Jose State to begin work on the Monterey Bay Aquarium project. In addition to his work at the aquarium, Dr. Webster serves on the board of trustees for the York School, the Sea Studios Foundation, the Monterey Academy of Oceanic Sciences, the Island Conservation and Ecology Group, is chair of the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary Advisory Council, and is chair of the Scientific Advisory Committee for the City of Monterey's Ed Ricketts Underwater Park. Stephen Webster has been a diving instructor and underwater photographer for 35 years. So I think you're well-equipped to discuss the state of the oceans since you're spending a good deal of your time in them. So welcome to you.
Thanks. Delighted to be here.
Yes. It seems to me that in discussing the fact that, I mean, what prompted me, you know, to want to do this show is that many people choose seafood as an option. Because they've over the years, people have eschewed red meat for whatever reason, you know, for many reasons, thinking that they were choosing a cleaner and safer alternative with fish. And anyone who's paying attention notices now that the price of fish has become restrictive, and there's been lots of press about some of the dangers of certain fishes. It seems to me that one of the tricky things we're faced with is correctly identifying where the root problems are in terms of management, protection, and sustainability.
Lena, it's a very thorny issue. It's real easy to say, oh, the problem is overfishing. We're just catching too many fish. But that's really an oversimplification. That can be a part of it. Loss of fish habitat that the fishes require for breeding and for growing. In some cases, there are strange management regulations that the fishermen have to abide by that result in wasted catch. For instance, if they, in one haul of a large net, exceed a quota, either for the targeted species or for a species in the wasted or bycatch that's brought in the trawl, they have no choice but to simply shovel it back over the side dead. They can't bring it to the dock where it could be effectively utilized. So there are lots and lots of different problems associated with the depletion of fisheries worldwide. But, you know, the bottom line, I think, really is that there are just too many mouths to feed. It really comes down to the market and how many people there are who either depend on seafood or elect to eat seafood. And it comes down eventually to the concept of carrying capacity, that the ocean can produce only so many tons of seafood each year. And we're getting to the point that we are beginning to overutilize that sustainable level of catch.
You know, it occurs to me that maybe we should go over the commonly held beliefs by people who are concerned, who may not be initiated, who may not be on the inside of environmental policy or activism, but who are concerned. I think that the common expectations or beliefs are that we have polluted the oceans to the point where eating any fish, for instance, in the bay, in either Monterey Bay or, well, Monterey Bay is a little cleaner than San Francisco Bay, but some of the bay areas, that eating the fish that are common or closer in, like snapper, is no longer a healthy choice.
Yeah.
That we've polluted. Go ahead.
That is a fairly localized problem around the world. There are areas like San Francisco Bay, some bays in Japan. Because of historical uses of those areas, it might be mercury having to do with processing gold during the gold rush, or it might be mercury in Japan involved with industrial processes. It might be sewage pollution or pesticide pollution in certain areas, either from historical uses or ongoing places where water quality just isn't regulated very well. On a global scale, those local problem areas, though, are fairly restricted compared to the overall decline in fish populations. So fishes in and whether they're healthy or not is certainly a good thing to be cognizant of and to think carefully about. But so is where are the fish coming from, and is what we are doing good for the environmental health?
Yes, it's sustainable.
Human health.
Right.
Yeah. And that's really the part of the question that the aquarium, that Audubon, a number of other conservation organizations around the country are homing in on with programs like our Seafood Watch and Audubon's Guide to Seafood, mm-hmm. where we're trying to give the consumer some tools to determine, okay, can I purchase this fillet in the freezer case without guilt, knowing that this comes from a well-managed, sustainable fishery or an environmentally friendly fish farm or aquaculture facility?
Okay, and I want to sort of unpack those two areas that you just brought up. But let's go back to the issue of fish as food.
Sure.
And the problems of pollution, because I know that this is what I hear from people a lot, is that they would like to eat fish, but they're concerned about the level of mercury that they're going to get. My understanding is that aside from fish that you, on your list, which is available on your website for the Monterey Bay Aquarium, and the website address is really www.monterey bay aquarium.org.
Right.
So, and they can go to Seafood Watch there to get this list. But aside from the obvious things that we just discussed, like being too close in and suffering pollution from the industrial waste and things like that, people sometimes believe that fish just have too much mercury in their tissues. My understanding, I read this somewhere, is that fish themselves actually have something in their tissues that protects them from mercury, and that you end up absorbing this material when you eat the fish.
Lena, I'm not a fish physiologist, so I can't really answer that for you. But because they are cold-blooded vertebrates with very different physiologies than ours, it wouldn't surprise me if they sequester the mercury somewhere in a way that it doesn't really interrupt their normal function. But then, like so many toxins in the environment, it gets passed up the food chain. And it's not until you get to the top carnivores that start concentrating these materials that it becomes a problem. DDT in the ocean works that way. It typically isn't a problem for the plankton, the invertebrates, the fishes, but when you get to the carnivorous birds like the pelicans or eagles that are feeding on those fishes, then it can become a problem in those cases, causing eggshell thinning.
Hmm. Yes, and I am concerned about the animals in the ecosystem, but for a moment I'm also trying to address the health issues of seafood as a choice.
Right.
So is it your opinion that eating fish has become a dangerous thing to do, aside from there's the sustainability issue, which we will go over, but in terms of whether or not even your best choices, whether seafood is now becoming, are you seeing in the marine mammals high concentrations of mercury, for instance?
You see high concentrations. I don't know about mercury. You do see PCBs, DDT, some of those kinds of things. And on the other hand, the California sea lion population is burgeoning and is higher now than it may ever have been in history. There's less DDT in the ocean right now than there has been any time since World War II. Now, we're replacing it with modern designer pesticides, most of which are supposed to be a lot short-lived, and it turns out some of them may not meet that test quite as well as one might hope. I think the bottom line is that unless you select your foodstuffs very, very carefully these days, and I'm sure you're a lot more on top of this subject than I am, it's very difficult to find anything that is pristine, that is absolutely uncontaminated by anything. Just to give you an idea, there's DDT in ocean water in the Antarctic Ocean, and yet it's never been applied within 6,000 miles of there. And so nothing is completely free of contamination these days. People who talk about pristine ocean water, I don't know where they're looking. But, on the other hand, from a public health point of view, most of these things are at low enough levels that at least they're not producing acute toxic results.
In the animals that are also eating fish.
In the animals, or in the people who eat the animals. Mm-hmm. And so then the question, what are the more long-term kind of insidious effects of these? And because they are long-term, and by and large the research hasn't been done for long periods of time, we just have to say we don't know.
Well, do you have studies to show, for instance, what's happening to native populations in Greenland, Eskimo populations, who still eat a diet that is predominantly fish and marine mammals? That was hard to say.
You're in a realm that's outside my
area
of knowledge.
All right.
I expect someone might be doing that, particularly if there were a reason for a public health concern of populations like that. And there certainly are a lot of native populations at high latitudes who depend a lot on seal pemmican and on animals that we know tend to concentrate a lot of these things. And I'm not aware that there are ongoing public health concerns about those populations of people. But again, I'm way outside my field of knowledge.
Well, let's go back to your field. Who has jurisdictions over these areas, and which countries get a good report card, and which are the worst, and why?
You really can't do it by country because there are good and bad actors within a country, and that's true of us. It's true of most of the major fishing countries around the world. And one of the complexities of this is that there are so many people in charge with overlapping jurisdictions or beyond, for instance, a country's economic zone, no jurisdictions. It requires international treaties among countries fishing on the high seas. And so it really is a very mixed bag. Just for coastal fisheries in California, close to shore, you begin with the State Department of Fish and Game. But then for migratory species, you're probably talking the National Marine Fisheries Service. And then there's the Pacific Fisheries Management Council. And then you get offshore for high seas gillnet fisheries and tuna fisheries and so forth. You get international kinds of agreements because a lot of those fish stocks circumnavigate the whole Pacific Basin in a year or during their lifetime. And so it doesn't do any good to manage the fish on one coast and not be coordinated with people doing similar things elsewhere around the Pacific. Or the Atlantic. The bluefin tuna in the Atlantic is a good case in point. They are fished heavily off of the southeast of this country, North and South Carolina, for instance. They're fished heavily in the Mediterranean. and the management of those two areas is totally different and done by people who, until recently, don't even talk to each other.
Mm.
Well, some of the research that's being done by Barbara Block at Hopkins, right next door to us here, is to implant archival tags in giant bluefin tuna on the East Coast, and then they have a $1,000 reward for the return of those tags. And that's enough of an incentive that the fishermen, when they catch a tuna and process it and find one of these banana-sized tags inside, send it back. And these tags have GPS recorders in them, depth recorders. They record the core temperature of the fish. We're learning a tremendous amount about the Atlantic bluefin just in the last year or two from this program. And one of the preliminary results is that the stocks off North Carolina are the same as the fishes that are caught in the Mediterranean. So if you're going to manage them, you have to do it on both sides of the ocean and involve people in a whole bunch of different countries. Well, that's a really tall order and is not something that you can do overnight. And the challenge with the bluefin is that a single large, high-quality bluefin tuna will sell for $80,000 in the Tokyo fish market for sushi.
Boy.
One fish, $80,000. Now, you know if a fish is going to sell for that much, there are going to be some people out there trying to poke them with harpoons.
Mm-hmm. It's good that you brought up, well, just briefly, let me ID the show. For those of you just tuning in, this is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Elena Berman, and I have by phone Dr. Stephen Webster from the Monterey Bay Aquarium. We're talking about seafood options, both from the standpoint of what fish are suitable for eating at this point, which fish are not, and which ones you might choose based on your concern about environmental concerns and sustainability concerns. It's good that you brought up tuna. I think that tuna is an interesting case history to give us some sense of the whole idea of what's going on in terms of how consumers are interacting with the market.
Mm-hmm.
And you just brought up a very chilling example of places like Japan that's willing to pay way too much for something, well, way too much in the sense of making it too attractive for people to destroy the population.
Right.
Tuna might be an example of a possible success story in terms of the consumers coming up against the marketplace,
mm-hmm.
in the aggressive campaign to preserve the health of dolphins and to
right.
avoid having them caught. Now, for a while, what we had was tremendous restriction, and it was really great, and that looks like it's starting to degrade now in terms of how, in other words, it looks like they're getting too loose again. What's happening with the regulation
well,
with that?
It does require international cooperation, and if other countries aren't really attentive to it, then you don't have the control over the bycatch problem that you want. And let me just...
Bycatch means getting other animals in with
yes.
the catch.
And let me tell you one of the quandaries with that fishery. Now, this is not bluefin tuna anymore. Now we're talking yellowfin tuna in the Pacific. And one of the advantages of fishing over dolphins is that those schools of yellowfin tuna tend to be single year classes, so they're all large fish. And the problem is that they tend to have dolphins under them, and you wrap the net around the tuna and you inevitably get dolphins, primarily spinners and a few mm-hmm. other dolphin species.
But there are these labels that do say they're dolphin safe, so
yeah,
what does that mean?
What that means is that after they've wrapped the net and started to bring it in, they then back down the net, meaning they drop the cork line of the net, the upper margin of the net that would normally be at the surface. For some reason, the dolphins have never learned to just jump over it and get out. In fact, they get crowded into these nets, and they kind of go catatonic. They start to look like cordwood. And so what they have to do is drop the cork line down and then literally encourage the dolphins out of the net, sort of chase them out.
Mm-hmm.
And doing that, they've managed to greatly reduce the dolphin catch. But on the other hand, it's very labor-intensive, very expensive, and the time they spend doing all of this, of course, they're not fishing. and they probably lose a few fishes at the same time. Anyway, it's doable. It works fairly well. Now, here's the downside, beyond the fact that there's still a small catch of dolphins. The downside is that a lot of fishermen, in order to avoid having to do all of that, simply avoid those large fishes. They'll fish mixed schools of tuna that have a lot of juvenile and younger tuna in them, and a lot of sharks and other species. And as a result, a huge bycatch of other fishes and tunas that are too small to be utilized. And so it's much, much more wasteful in other species, not dolphins, but other species like sharks and juvenile tunas.
And sharks are in trouble.
Yeah, and so you may say, okay, it's dolphin safe, but is it ecosystem safe?
Yeah, exactly. Now, you list on your Seafood Watch chart, which is, again, available on the website for the Monterey Bay Aquarium, which is www.montereybayaquarium.org, under Seafood Watch, that albacore tuna is caught with a hook and a line.
Off this coast, it is.
In the Pacific Ocean.
It may be netted, but here, we're actually going to move albacore from the yellow zone, the cautionary zone, over to Best Choices.
Well, it's in Best Choices as of the other day when I pulled it up.
Good. We've already done that.
Yeah. So albacore is then reasonably safe. You know, I have to stop for a moment because I can hear the voices of my listeners saying, boy, isn't this just a really good case for people not eating seafood and really either raising their own vegetables and becoming vegetarians so that they don't destroy populations, and or farmed fish, which we'll talk about in a minute. We'll talk about, in other words, what I'm trying to say to people is hold tight, because I will get to the idea of, well, what can we do that's sustainable here? Is it reasonable to eat fish? So for now, the albacore tuna is line raised. Now, I didn't see any mention of tongol tuna, which has become very popular recently because they make a big fuss, especially in the health food stores. There is a brand in particular that makes a big fuss about how dolphin safe they are. But my guess is that tongol is going to be the same problem as the yellowfin.
If it's a sane fishery, if it's a netted fishery, that's S-E-I-N-E, not S-A-N-E, then it probably has those same bycatch.
Okay, so albacore is going to be, if you're going to eat tuna, albacore is a better choice.
Albacore is a very clean fishery. It's a hook and line fishery. There's virtually no bycatch. And here last year, they could hardly give them away. The boats were coming into the docks with abundant catches of albacore, and the canneries couldn't take them, and they were selling them off the boats at very cheap rates. So it's a very good choice. If you are of a mind that in order for humans to eat anything, including vegetables, we do have an impact, and even if you're not using fertilizers and pesticides, we do have an impact.
I agree.
Because wherever you are growing those vegetables, mm-hmm. you don't have gophers and ground squirrels and the normal critters, wildlife, if you will, that would be living in that space.
That's a very important point.
So there is no such thing as a zero-impact food-producing system. I just don't mm-hmm. believe it.
No, I agree with you. And really, throughout human history, in my sense of when human health, in terms of when we look at the fossil records, human health gets balanced with the health of the planet is when, in fact, agriculture and food production or hunting is done in what we call a sustainable fashion. In other words, when rules are observed,
sure.
and when things are, and that in fact that animal husbandry is as part of agriculture early on was very important and played a role, because not all land is suitable for growing food, and in fact some of the rainforests that are being torn down are being torn down for soybean production,
yeah.
not for
yeah,
cattle.
Lots of the
so
places we're doing it now is having huge impacts. All the topsoil we lose every year that goes down into the Gulf of Mexico, down the Mississippi.
Yeah. So the real issue here is getting disciplined and detail-oriented in terms of what we do. And I think that the importance of doing a show like this is that the consumer can vote with their money. So that's one thing we can do is we can buy
Right.
Based on what we believe to be sustainable. So why don't we talk, well, let's see, we're going to need to take a break in about 3 minutes. Why don't we talk for a bit about what we mean by sustainable? What's a sustain? Because we just talked about tuna, and there they are. You know, they're doing okay. Yeah. So what do we mean by sustainable? Not in the obvious sense, but in a more particular sense.
The National Marine Fisheries Service has a definition, and often for many fish stocks like rockfishes along this coast, their definition is: if the fishing activity year after year maintains a population at 40% of its pre-hunt numbers or better, then that's sustainable. And that 40% is often the target for defining sustainability. Now, that may sound low, but keep in mind a fish population of young and middle-aged fishes that's actively growing is going to be a lot more productive than a population of old-growth fishes. And so that 40% number is indicative of a population that is continuing to grow rapidly and therefore can continue to maintain that level of fishing. It's kind of the difference between an actively growing forest versus an old growth forest, where you really get more productivity year after year in a younger, actively growing forest.
Yeah, but you still need to protect the old growth. So what would be old growth in terms of the ocean?
Would there be something? Old growth would be to be sure that in your fishery you're not removing too many of the reproductively mature animals.
Yeah.
And that's why our concern about the American lobster on the East Coast, the Maine lobster, that's why it's in the red. The average lobster in that fishery that in terms of numbers and tonnage is holding up is a 1.5-pound lobster that hasn't reproduced yet. And so the concern is, gee, are we leaving any breeders out there or allowing any lobsters to go to breeding age? And one bad year, the whole system might collapse. So that's why lobsters are on the red part of the card, for instance.
We're going to take a brief 30-second break here. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman. I'm on the phone with Dr. Stephen Webster from the Monterey Bay Aquarium. In fact, he's been with them since the very beginning of the aquarium. He's quite an expert marine biologist. We're discussing sustainable seafood choices and how we can vote with our dollar and also protect our health in the meantime. We're going to take a 30-second musical break, and we'll come right back with the interview. Welcome back. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman. I'm on the phone with Dr. Stephen Webster, who is the senior marine biologist at the Monterey Bay Aquarium. And we're discussing, among other things, their Seafood Watch chart, which is available on their website at www.montereybayaquarium.org. Monterey Bay Aquarium, one word, and you look under Seafood Watch. They also have the Audubon Guide to seafood, which is also wonderful and explains a lot about all of this, how to choose and what to choose and what are your best and worst choices. The main difference I see between the two is that the Audubon seems to be less regional than the Monterey Bay Aquarium Seafood Watch. The Monterey Bay Aquarium Seafood Watch is very regional for us in California. It has all the latest news about our specifics here on the Pacific Coast. A little reminder, if you miss parts of today's show and you want to get a cassette copy, I do not have transcripts, you can call my information number for information on how to do that, to get a cassette. It's 707-773-4727. Or you can go to my website, you delete www and type in members.aol.com/YOHAF, Your Own Health and Fitness. We've been talking about the fact what exactly sustainability means in terms of how much is left in terms of the fish and how many of them can still breed and stuff. But I wonder whether we're also competing. Well, here we are eating tons of tuna. Who are we competing with in the ocean who deserves to live too, that would have been eating those tuna?
sharks, but we've already caught them, so it doesn't really matter.
Now, sharks are one of the bad news stories here, too.
Excuse me?
Yeah, sharks are one of the bad news stories
sharks
here, too.
Perhaps right up there is the worst news story of fisheries. They don't lend themselves to being a good fishery item, for one thing. They're very slow to mature, slow to grow, they're long-lived, and they're not very fecund. They don't produce very many offspring each year. So shark populations around the world, one after another, get hunted down, certainly below commercial levels, and if not commercial extinction, there are a few that may even be close to biological extinction. A single bowl of shark fin soup in China sells for $90. So there you are again. If it's getting so scarce that it's that pricey, you know they're going to keep trying to go after those last few fish.
I might be one of the few people in the world, because I've never been attacked by a shark, so that may be why I feel this way, but I don't think of them as just large vacuum cleaners. I think of them as being viable creatures. And but I wonder whether people sort of think, well, who cares if they go extinct? We have no competition. We could eat all the tuna salad we want. Don't they play a role, very important role in the ecosystem, aside from being really amazing creatures?
Absolutely, just as top carnivores in any ecosystem do, removing the halt and the lame and keeping the predator pressure on the evolution of the prey populations so that the more fit of the prey species tend to survive, etc. This whole aspect of ecosystem services that all these different kinds of plants and animals provide is one that it's real easy to lose sight of. I think it's, I keep referring back to Aldo Leopold's admonition that it's the first law of intelligent tinkering is be sure and keep all the pieces.
Mm-hmm. I like that.
And this globe is, and the biosphere is set up to function the way it is because of millions of years of evolution with things co-evolving with reference to one another. And we may not think it that we'd have a lot of trouble getting along without mosquitoes or ants or gophers, but chances are some rather critical things would change if we didn't have those animals.
So we're not recommending sharks as a source of food for people. We are allowing people to eat mahi-mahi, however, which is this fish that I haven't seen. I'm afraid if I saw it in the ocean, I'd never be able to eat it again. I'm such a wimp. I was in the tropics at one point, and I went to a fish market to buy some food, and they had all these tropical fish laying there in all their different colors, and
mm-hmm.
I couldn't buy them, and people were laughing at me, you know.
Mahi is an open water predatory fish. They are gorgeous. You would probably have trouble eating mahi-mahi. They're known as dorado in Latin America or dolphin fish, but they aren't a dolphin. They are a fish. And that's one that seems to be holding up pretty well in most parts of the world.
I'd like to go over some more of the sorts of things that people eat very commonly and whether or not they're okay to eat, because there are some heartbreaking stories here. And then I want to talk about fish farming.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're going to end up with it anyway, because here we go. Here are two things that people like to eat. Well, three things that bring up the issue of farming. One is shrimp, which is a really heartbreaking story.
Yeah.
Looks like it's never a good idea to buy shrimp.
Unfortunately, we're still looking for the shrimp farm we can recommend, and we're getting some help from folks at the World Wildlife Fund in identifying a responsibly run fish farm, perhaps in Ecuador.
Okay, so let's go ahead and say, what is the problem with farming? Well, I mean, there's the obvious problem of industrial farming of any sort where the animals are tortured by being squished into, you know, just treated badly. But then there's the other issues of chemicals and the things that they do to the environment. So let's give people the bad news about fish farming.
Different problems with different kinds of different species. For instance, relative to shrimp farming, it is now a $6 billion a year global industry. 300% increase in the developed world in shrimp consumption in just the last 10 years. 300% increase in the last 10 years. 850 million pounds a year in the U.S. In 20 years, 2.5 million acres worldwide have been destroyed to become shrimp ponds. And typically, those coastal wetlands are mangroves in the tropics. Well, it turns out mangroves are extremely important as nursery grounds for a whole lot of fin fishes and lobsters and other animals that grow up among the mangrove roots and then move out onto the coral reef or into the grass flats as adults. And so while you're plowing under natural nursery habitat, you're growing a crop that then sells at a level that it doesn't feed any of the local native populations. So you're putting native fishermen out of business in order to sell high-priced shrimp in the developed world at $7, $8, $9 a pound.
And we're talking about prawns as well as shrimp, are we not?
You're talking both. You know, there is a biological distinction between a shrimp and a prawn.
I think to them there is, probably, yes.
In the fish market vernacular, a big shrimp is a prawn.
Right.
But a lot of things we buy as prawns because they're big actually turn out to be shrimps, but we don't need to get into that one.
But the problems are the same.
The problems are the same. In Ecuador, for instance, a fifth of their mangroves have now been converted to shrimp ponds. Over 500,000 acres of mangrove in Thailand has been converted to shrimp ponds. The ponds typically are crowded. They have disease problems, nutrient buildup. In many places, it's kind of like slash-and-burn agriculture rainforest. They work for about 3 or 4 years, and then they have to abandon them and move on and plow under more mangroves to make more shrimp ponds. It became such a problem in India that the government there recently closed 100 shrimp farms because they realized they were shooting themselves in both feet by continuing to destroy their mangroves.
So we are clearly not recommending shrimp and prawns to people anymore, huh?
Farm shrimp, unless we can begin to identify some that are being done sustainably and responsibly, and we're working on that. There may be some farms in Ecuador that are away from the coast, and this is possible other places, too. We just haven't nailed them down yet. One problem is that the farm that we think has been identified ships only 15-ton containers at a time. Well, at the aquarium here, we don't need a 15-ton container of shrimp. So what you have to do is find a distributor who will take that tonnage and then market it as good, high-quality, sustainable shrimp.
So I do see on your seafood chart that the options are, if you really have to have shrimp, that you can buy Pacific Bay shrimp, although you're somewhat concerned, you're proceeding with caution here now in this, that there's some bycatch, that other things are being caught when those are being caught.
But for the bay shrimp, and that's the little shrimp that's normally in your shrimp, Louie.
Yep.
For the bay shrimp, the bycatch tends to be less of a concern than it is for most other shrimp trawl fisheries around the world. And the wild-caught shrimp around the world have huge bycatch problems. Typically, anywhere from 1 pound of shrimp to 4 pounds of bycatch to, in the Sea of Cortez, 1 pound of shrimp to 40 pounds of bycatch. They don't even pay for their diesel fuel in a night of fishing down in the Gulf of California. And if they weren't subsidized by the Mexican government, there's no way that fishery could even operate. So in addition to the bycatch, and by the way, some of the fishermen in the Gulf, particularly off Georgia, the Gulf of Mexico, are using turtle excluder devices. So they're pretty well taking care of the turtle bycatch problem. But there still is a large bycatch of sharks and finfishes associated with virtually any shrimp fishery.
Another fish that people eat quite a bit of is salmon, and salmon is rather complicated.
Salmon's very complicated. One would think that salmon farming ought to be the panacea.
Dreadful.
Yeah.
They're dreadful.
Turns out high waste buildup, it takes for salmon 100 and where are my numbers here? To produce, say, 100 pounds of salmon, you're using about 300 pounds of fish meal. So you're catching 300 pounds of another fish to produce 100 pounds of salmon, whereas you could simply use that bait fish as human food in the first place and be much more efficient. There's something like 500,000 escaped Atlantic salmon in the Pacific Northwest, and now there's some evidence that some of them may be breeding. And that's cause for concern about how they might then interact with, compete with, the native salmon stocks, many of which are in danger. And then there's also the problem of introduced diseases and the use of antibiotics.
Yes.
Crowding in the pen.
Yes. Yeah, it's not a clean source of food. And they're sold in, the farmed salmon is all that's available during the winter months.
In many cases, actually,
no, just it's very hard to find.
And we have found that if you look for your supplier, you can find wild-caught Alaskan salmon all year long. You just have
wow.
to find a supplier that has a stock of it.
I haven't found it even in the health food stores around here. It's
not
all farmed.
Be fresh, of course. It'll be frozen. But
yeah. Well, then maybe some of the companies that do. Yeah, actually, I'm thinking that some of the larger companies that sell flash frozen fish,
right.
Which incidentally is interesting too, because another problem with fish is that they put sulfites all over the fish when they get them in to keep them. Some fisheries do and some don't, but that's another thing to ask
yeah.
is whether your stuff has been covered with preservatives. So the flash frozen stuff that gets frozen right on the right away is usually cleanest.
I saw a survey done, a small one. It was I think in California, where people were asked to compare farmed salmon. It was a taste test. Compare the farmed salmon with Alaska wild caught salmon, and the salmon didn't even hold a candle.
Oh, it's awful. The texture's off. It's terrible.
Yeah.
So in California, should we indulge ourselves in some fresh Pacific salmon during the season, or is that even dicey now?
We have it in the yellow zone, and I think it, for the time being, is one that you can feel okay about. The salmon trawlers in California engage in what's called a salmon stamp program, where they basically fund the hatchery operation. We have messed up the habitat for salmon with all the dams in the San Joaquin and Sacramento River watersheds, to the point that to maintain a healthy salmon fishery, we have to do these hatchery programs. The fishermen support those programs, and so by and large, we think that based on continued good numbers each year, that this is a sustainable fishery and one we can support. The reason it's in the caution zone is we still need to keep thinking about the habitat and the watershed and improving the native stocks as well as maintaining these hatchery stocks.
Now, I noticed that before we end the show, too, we should talk about some of the stuff that people can eat with confidence, like some of the tunas that we've discussed, the albacore being one. But many of the fish that you recommend now are farmed, because I guess, that's getting realistic here about how to maintain the levels of fish that people want to eat.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them are farmed. We've talked about some of the bad news with fish farming. Is there any good news with fish farming?
The fish farming that is not done in the ocean. So you don't have the waste buildup, you don't have the escapees, and that's where things like catfish, trout, striped bass, sturgeon, tilapia, all farmed in contained freshwater systems that can be well managed.
And I see that they're being fed a vegetable-based diet, too.
Well, it depends on the fish.
Tilapia, well, catfish
is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'm not sure about sturgeon. There may be quite a bit of plant material in their diet as well. Probably the striped bass and the trout are getting fish meal made from fish, or at least partially. But those tend to be pretty efficient conversion rates, and in terms of environmental effects, they seem to be done responsibly.
But don't they still throw antibiotics into the water?
it would depend on the farmer and how crowded they are and what problems he or she has. It's not unusual, yeah.
So it might be a good question to ask if you're
question to
butcher
ask
knows.
Your fish seller, sure.
Yeah. Okay, so some of the other fish that are still okay, one of the good news fish is the Pacific Coast calamari.
Yeah, the squid have their ups and downs, often in concert with our El Niños coming and going. And you know, that long-term climate change thing is another element in this. We have to be cognizant that this is a movie, not a snapshot we're talking about. The system keeps changing over several different time scales. And so what's a great place for salmon today may not be 20 or 30 years from now if the ocean keeps warming and if El Niños keep getting more severe and more frequent. We tend to have declines in anchovies and in squids during warm water El Niño periods. And we really haven't bounced back from the whomping El Nino we had in 1997 and 98 to a good, full, vibrant squid fishery yet. It's expected that they will, but it has its ups and downs. So that one is in the green, but it might not always be there for you to enjoy, depending on what El Nino is doing.
And the Dungeness crab from Northern California looks like it's still a possible choice during its season.
Right.
Although, aren't crabs bottom feeders? Aren't they a little bit polluted?
I don't eat enough crab ever to have been worried about that. And just because you're a bottom feeder, if you're not near a sewer outfall, that doesn't mean you're
well. But what about our bays, though? They're pulling them up out of our bay.
Typically, they're outside the Golden Gate.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right. Pacific halibut looks like it's okay.
Yep, that's largely an Alaskan fishery, and that's the Alaska halibut. The California halibut along this coast, I'm not sure we even have it on the list.
You do. You have U.S. Pacific Coast or Alaska as fully fished, but still
okay.
Pretty good populations.
Yeah, no, I was looking at the abbreviated one, not the longer one. Yeah.
And New Zealand cod looks like it's okay. Hoki looks like it's okay. So we've got several things we can... And then, of course, there are things that... Oh, no, I don't see it here. Mackerel. Mackerel was on the other list, on the Audubon.
Yeah. Lena, you know, there are a lot of things that aren't on our list at all.
Yeah.
People called up and asked, well, what about sand dabs or this, that, or another fish? If it is not on the list and it is on this coast, you can assume that it's probably okay. We wanted to keep this manageable, and so this isn't an exhaustive list of commercially fished species along this coast.
Well, the Audubon can fill in, and you've got that on the website as well.
It can fill in, although they're not really very West Coast.
No, they're not. It's not.
They
only
have lingcod, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, you have to kind of go a little beyond these lists if you can. But you're going to start seeing things in fish markets that aren't on anybody's list. And that's because as we fish down the common fishes, they're moving to things they used to think of as trash fish.
Mm.
I had a call last week about escolar that people are seeing more commonly in the markets. Boy, we had to do a little digging to find out what escolar is. And it turns out it's a fish that swims with the tunas.
Oh.
And normally wasn't harvested, and now it is and is showing up in the markets. We don't know very much at all about its stocks or its management. So for the time being, I would say, sure, go ahead and try escolar.
What about people who like to swill down raw oysters? What do we
That's
have to tell
where
them?
I would be very careful about their point of origin and to make sure that it's a good, clean site where they're being farmed and that they're being held and cleaned somewhat in holding tanks before being marketed because they are raw.
Okay, so they're all going to be farmed, and some of the farming techniques might be questionable, so that might be a concern. And you might be swilling down a lot of antibiotics, too.
In a better location than others, or if they were in a farm where they had a flood and a lot of agricultural waste went into the water... you know, I expect what they do is then hold them for a longer period of time and get them cleaned up. But and I don't think a responsible fish seller would market animals like that because they'd know they're likely going to get bitten.
Scallops are another big popular guy.
Mm-hmm.
Scallops, it looks like you're saying bay scallops from New England, but it does. I don't see anything about scallops from our bay.
I don't know that any scallops are harvested these days in San Francisco Bay.
Or in Monterey or anything. So they're all going to be from New England. And
those
I see they're
gonna, that's an East Coast fishery.
That's an East, okay. Mm-hmm. And that's what you've got then in your caution.
Right.
What about the sea vegetables that are being harvested? How are they being affected by the state of the oceans these days? A lot of people are eating seaweed of various sorts.
Mm-hmm. Lots of those are cultured. Many of them, most of them probably coming from the Orient. Any that are legal to take along our coast, and you have to be very careful where you are because there are lots of marine protected areas where harvesting seaweed is not legal. But in those cases, if you're on the outer coast, away from any municipality's sewer outfall, I would expect you're in fine shape.
And lastly, I guess I'd really like to hear what you want. I mean, you're a person who I think probably has a very churchy feeling about the ocean. You're surrounded by it daily, either in your work or in your diving and photographing. What's your plea? What do you want to see happen here?
I think it's that we need to start paying attention, and because most of the ocean is out of sight and out of mind, it's very easy to assume everything's just fine when you go to the supermarket or the fish market or the seafood restaurant. And I think the consumers have the ability to require that the fish providers pay attention to these concerns. And if we start asking for that kind of information and they don't have it, to let them know, well, the next time I come back, I'd like to patronize you, but I hope you'll have that information for me. I think it's at the consumer level that we can at least let the suppliers know that we're concerned about these things. And hopefully it will start to result in more and more fisheries that will be done sustainably and more healthy aquaculture farms. And, of course, the fishermen recognize, too, that it's to their advantage. They don't want to fish themselves out of business. And more often than not, it's not simple overfishing. It's a complex combination of habitat health and management as well as the fishing activity.
Now, there's a variety of sources on your website. Again, it's www.montereybayaquarium.org, and there's a whole lot of different resources for the consumer. You have other types of information sources. One of them that I found very impressive also was the Marine Stewardship Council. Had a lot of very interesting information. So there's so much on that
really
website.
A wealth of information.
Uh-huh. So if people also want to get involved directly, there's probably places to contact if you want to volunteer and do some work or learn more. But it sounds like what you're really recommending to people is not that they eschew seafood, but that they just make educated choices by looking at keeping in touch with your seafood watch list.
Make educated choices, support the folks who are doing it responsibly and well, and let those who aren't know that you're going to avoid their products and why.
Well, I really want to thank you for taking time out from your work, and I'm so grateful to all of you at the Monterey Bay Aquarium for the work that you do there. It is the most thrilling experience I've had and continue to have to go there, and it gives me such a sense of reassurance about the human race to go there.
Well, thanks, Lena, and thanks for the chance to share some of these thoughts with your listeners.
It was a real pleasure.
Terrific.
Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm.
Bye.
Bye.
I'm Lena Berman, and I want to thank you for listening. If you need more information or want a cassette copy of this or any other in the series Your Own Health and Fitness, you can call my information number 24 hours a day at 707-874-2772. For a list of other available shows, information about guests, and news about the nonprofit and the benefits of membership, and to listen to the show free online, go to the website yourownhealthandfitness.org. Your Own Health and Fitness is a joint production of Your Own Health and Fitness and KPFA-FM. The engineer for your own health and fitness is Vinnie Beecham. Remember, being informed not only protects your health, it protects your freedom.